Be welcoming Miriam Weilenmann from Vienna to give the talk. So Miriam did her PhD in York and then is now a postdoc in Vienna, and she has interest in quantum information and quantum foundations. So thank you, take it away.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. Also, thanks for the interest in our paper and for inviting me to present it here. The project on quantum preparation games is a joint work with Edgar Aguilar and Miguel Navasquez, who are also based in Vienna. And it's not yet published, but available on the archive in case anyone is interested. And please feel free to interrupt me if anything is unclear or if you can't hear me or anything. Okay, so I want to start with the motivation. So the motivation for our work was kind of that we wanted to find ways or good protocols to certify or quantify quantum resources. And as an example, you can think of entanglement, and this is actually also the main application we've been looking at. Of course, if I say we want to certify entanglement, then we have good ways to do this. So for instance, we can do full tomography of a state, and then we can also decide if it's entangled. Or alternatively, we can find a witness, and there are standard constructions like taking the fidelity with respect to some pure state, and that give us good witnesses and that we can use. But now, of course, both of those methods don't always apply necessarily. So for instance, if the systems become larger, then the tomography may be not so practical or even infeasible. And in the case of entanglement witnesses, these standard constructions maybe don't apply. And then it's still a problem to really find good witnesses for a particular state or a particular set of states. And then also something we have to take care of if we actually want to detect them is that we need a witness that we can also easily implement. So for instance, it may be that our state is distributed between various parties, and this means that we can only do certain local operations on the state. And then, of course, we need to kind of find kind of witnesses that help us do that, and also optimize with respect to the capabilities we have. And so what we're proposing in this work is this framework of preparation games that kind of gives us a systematic way to find good protocols for certifying and quantifying quantum resources. And in some cases, as we will see, we can also really, really optimize those protocols, and under certain conditions, find the optimal protocols. Okay, and this is what kind of I want to talk to you about. I want to start just with the general setting. So a quantum preparation game, what we assume is that we have a player and we have a referee. And they play a game for N rounds. And so a round consists of the player preparing some state. So we care about detecting state resources here. And the player has a certain ability. So if we care about entanglement, we could have a player who is maybe only able to prepare separable states, or a player who always prepares singlets, or various types of players. So generally they can prepare systems that are in some set, and this is in general a convex set of states that they can prepare. Okay, and then the states each round, a state is sent to the referee, and what the referee does is he chooses a way to measure the state. So he chooses some measurement device, and then records this in some classical memory. So we assume here that the referee does not hold the quantum memory, so he cannot just keep all the systems he gets for N rounds and then do some global operation on them. But we assume that every round the referee will measure the state. And then at the end of after N rounds, depending on this state of his classical memory of what he's recorded about the measurements, he will score the player. And the scoring rule will somehow reflect whether we believe the player has prepared the resource kind of we require. So this is a way to think about this. And then a play for any player strategy, what we can do is we can compute an expected score. Okay, and the expected score is just the probability that the player reaches a configuration of the referee's memory S times the expected score for that, and then sums over all possibilities. Okay, and I want to say a bit more about the referee, because this is actually how we design the protocols. This is what kind of the detection protocol is. As I said, in each round, what will happen is that the referee obtains a state from the player. He will perform a measurement. And in order to choose his measurement, what he can use is the information that he has recorded previously. Okay, and then depending on what he chose and what outcome he got, he can update his classical memory system in this round. And then the next round, he can again use this information. Now, the player kind of knows what the game is. So he knows what he's supposed to prepare and how he's going to be scored. And he also knows the referee's strategy. But we also kind of let the player have access to this classical memory in every state. So what this means is that we account, for instance, for players who, if we ask for an entangled state, cannot actually prepare that, but they can only prepare separable states. And now what they could try to do is kind of prepare different separable states in order to try to change our classical memory states so they can pretend to prepare the resource we're asking for. And so we kind of want to have protocols that also work against players who try to cheat somehow. And so we give kind of the player also access of this information. Okay, and so then what we can see from this is that it's relatively straightforward to compute and also to optimize the score for a player. So he will know kind of depending on in each round, depending on the configuration of the classical memory of the referee, what his measurement strategy will be. And he will also know how he's going to be scored in the end, depending on that classical state. And so what he can then do is really start kind of with the last round, because he knows how long they're going to play, and compute which, depending on this memory state, which of the possible states that he's actually able to prepare, so which state from his set he should give. Okay, and then he can optimize this for the last round, and then we can kind of recursively go through the chain of all rounds, and for each step we can find which is the best state the player should be preparing here in order to in the end maximize his expected score. Okay, another thing we can see in writing this in a recursive way is that also each of those terms depends linearly on the measurement elements. And this is important also because we will want to also optimize these things for the player, and in order to do this is relevant for the referee, and in order to optimize this also for the referee, this will be relevant. Okay, so we can do this, and then there is also a particular class of preparation games that I want to mention. So what we can do is we can really look at maybe a setup where there is a particular set of measurements that can be implemented. So we can assume that we have a particular set of measurements that we can choose from. And if we have such a set and require that the referee essentially records all the information about which measurement he chooses and which outcome he gets. And in each round, we can use all the information about previous rounds to make this choice of the next measurement, then we call this a Maxwell-Lehman game. So what this means is that essentially for this particular set of measurements, and this is kind of the most general thing we can do, because we always retain full information and we don't throw anything away. And we'll see later that these we can nicely optimize. So these will come up. Okay, and we can also see that then the memory, of course, grows exponentially with the round number. So this is kind of the overview on what preparation games are, and now I want to give an illustration of some of them that should explain this. Okay, so now this is, sorry.
Sorry, can I just clarify, sure. Are the number of rounds fixed or are you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, so for this optimization, it is you can then of course, you could decide to, for instance, repeat the game and then do it for a larger round numbers. But here, because we start in this recursive way, kind of I assume there is a number n that I know for now. Yes. There is also, okay, I have something more to say to that. So what you could also do is you could allow for and you'll see that in this in an example. So for instance, if you certify entanglement, you can, for instance, allow for kind of an outcome that corresponds to aborting or making a decision earlier. So you can, in that sense, have a variable round number where you decide on an outcome come a bit earlier. So this is something you could impose if you want. And in general, I would say it's fixed. Yes, thanks for the question. Okay, so now, okay, preparation game, what I need to fix is kind of measurements, how I record my information about them, and then a scoring in the end. And so this is now an example where this memory wouldn't grow exponentially, but just in this way. So if we So often we are in a situation where we want to kind of quantify a resource where we know that a certain amount of parameters in the description of the state, for instance, will matter for us whether it's resourceful or not. And in this case, of course, we can kind of more ad hoc just construct as a collection of some measurements, where here I assume they're just plus minus one outcome measurements that give us information about this. Okay, so we can have a probability distribution according to which we kind of choose among those measurements. And then we can just introduce a counter for each of them. So every time, so we will have a counter for each measurement that we initialize in the state zero. And then every time we do a certain measurement, we do either plus one or minus one, depending on our outcome in this particular measurement. Okay, and then in the end we have this collection of counters, and based on this we can score the player because it will give us information about the information we kind of want about the system. And now one particular example, so I say here this comes from gradient descent. So one particular example is that we could do kind of gradient descent in this way. And what I mean with this is that for instance we can have a situation where we know which parameters kind of matter for the resourcefulness, and we can construct a measurement that kind of singles out the state that have particular values of these parameters. Okay, and then what we can do is we can use kind of the other measurements to encode the gradient of this particular observable we're measuring. And then by kind of probabilistically choosing between them, we can update those counters and use those to actually, so I say here that the measurements can depend on the round number, so we can use those counters to also update the measurements from round to round, kind of towards the parameters that we actually have in our system. So this is a possibility, and because I think this is a bit vague the way I describe it, I have an example. Okay, so one example, a simple example where one can do this is if we want to describe, for instance, two-qubit entanglement. So if you have a promise that we have a state of this form, then I could say, okay, now I want to quantify the entanglement. So really the parameter that matters is the theta. And really I could, for instance, want to give the binary entropy of the cosine squared as a measure of its entanglement. And now, in the way that I kind of try to say, what I now would like to have is a measurement that singles out this state essentially. So I want a measurement where this is the only eigenstate to eigenvalue one in this particular case. Okay, and this is a way to construct this. So I restrict now to local measurements because these we can usually also implement and allow them to be adaptive from Alice to Bob. So a way that I can construct kind of an observable that does this for me is I can let the first on one system, I let Alice measure either in the 0, 1 or in the plus minus basis. And then depending on which basis she chose and which outcome she got, Bob will do a measurement. So if she measured in the 0, 1 basis, the state will be in 0 or 1. So Bob should do the same basis. But now if she measured in the plus minus basis, then we'd like to Bob to do kind of a rotated basis measurement here. Okay, and this depends on the outcome, either this or this. And this is an operator that has this property that this is really the only eigenvector to eigenvalue one. And now if I would really know that I am given this state, all I can do is do kind of n times this measurement. I will kind of be relatively certain if I have this state or not. And if I have it, I can say, okay, and my score is the binary entropy of the cosine square of this. Now the problem is that I have this parameter and I don't really know this. And so then I introduce in this case only one second measurement that essentially implements this gradient. And what I now do is anytime I do this measurement, I will update my counter too. And for this, I will have an update rule for this angle here. And then I will go to the next round with the new measurement and again choose probabilistically between the two and update this again, whichever measurement I do. And then in the end, I can just kind of score a player by first of all making taking the binary entropy of the cosine square of my angle estimate, which I get from this second counter, times some Heaviside function, because I want to be sure that with this measurement I actually see whether I have this state or not. And so if I get a value that I could also get, for instance, with a separable state or with a low, not very entangled state, I set the score to 0 because I think this didn't work. Okay, and so this is kind of, okay, I tried to give you an intuition how we could come up with such a game, but of course this doesn't say anything yet. So what I really have to do is I have to see what actually the scores are that I can get. Okay, and this is now for 40 rounds. I have some examples here. So 40 is not an upper bound, it's just an example. So if I really have a player who chooses a theta and every round prepares that state, I can see that depending on the theta, I really get kind of a curve as I expected, where the average the expected score expresses how entangled the state is. Okay, and the red line is here what I can get with the best separable strategy. So if really in every round I really optimize the score. So this is better than if I take, for instance, just the state with the angle 0 here, because I can actually have an adaptive strategy. Okay, so in this case, this works reasonably well. And then we can also see what happens with other players, because it doesn't mean we can only do this if we have these particular states. So what we can also see is we can say, okay, now we look at someone who can prepare any state up to a certain negativity, okay, which is defined in this way. And what we can then see if these players are allowed again adaptive strategy to do whatever they want, just up to that negativity. What we find then is that essentially we get this curve of expected scores. So we can see that kind of the expected score in some sense also allows us to estimate this negativity in some sense. And we can again see that if we have essentially here any state, we do better than if we're restricted to this particular form here. Okay, so this is a way how we can just come up with preparation games and then analyze the kind of performance of different players. What is not so clear in this case, I mean, of course, I could have come up with a different operator W, and it might give us a better game. So it's not really optimizing different games. And for instance, the distribution with which I choose the different measurements is also something I can vary, and that gives me various results. So not all work equally well. But so kind of to see how I can really, really in some cases optimize those preparation games, I have to go to kind of a different example. And this is kind of performing hypothesis test, because there it's quite clear what we want to optimize and then also to compare. Compare this. Okay, so again, an example here could be that we want to certify, in this case, so not quantify, but just certify that a state row is entangled, again in n rounds. So this would mean that we want to distinguish the state from any separable strategy. So in a hypothesis test, I mean, the null hypothesis here would be that we prepare separable states. And what this means in the language of preparation games then is that in the end, we really just want to do a binary decision whether we have certified the entanglement or not. And if we think we have certified it, we assign a score of 1. And if we think we have not, then we assign a score of 0. Okay, and then it's quite clear how we would assess the quality of the protocol, because just in terms of the errors that we make, because it's a binary decision. And so in this case, the type 1 error then would be the probability that we detect a separable strategy as entangled, and the type 2 error is the other way around. Okay, and we can see that if we think as preparation games, this is really just the maximal expected score that we could get for any separable strategy here. So we can see this as expected scores. And this would be 1 minus the expected score for the state row in this case. Okay, so in this case, we kind of what we want to do for optimizing them is really minimize those two errors. And so then what we can do is looking into trying to design good or optimal protocols, and also under the assumption that we have some restrictions on the referee. Okay, now how does the optimization work? So here I've just kind of written down what such an optimization problem would look like, and this is just a 1-round version. Okay, what I've written here is just that this probability that we've seen before should be upper bound by some constant E2, and the expected score here that we've also seen before for any separable state should be upper bounded by a constant E1. And now I've phrased this in kind of an asymmetric way where we would fix the type 1 error and minimize the other one, but one could also switch them or take some linear combination or so. Okay, so this is the problem we want to solve. And this can actually be written as an SVP. So in particular, this condition here, we can think of kind of taking everything to the over to this side. So then we can take the E1 time, kind of the E1 times identity into this trace. So we'll take everything into the trace. And what we can kind of see is that we have some operator times the sigma should be larger than 0. Okay, and all this means is then that this operator should be an entanglement witness really for this to work. And these kinds of problems we can then solve by kind of going to the dual to the separable states and kind of requiring this operator that is multiplied with the state to be in kind of the dual set there. And the way we really do this is we look at the DPS hierarchy for separability. So we look at approximations of the set of separable states, and for each of them we get kind of a dual. So we get a dual hierarchy, which is also available in one of those papers. that kind of gives us an inner approximation to all of those, to the entanglement witnesses. In the general case, in the cubic case, we can just take PPT. Okay, and so this way we can now see that these are semi-definite constraints, so it's all just a semi-definite program. And we can optimize this. And we can also do this if we have more than one round. There are two things I wanted to remark. So far it's kind of, I've just given you the simplest example where I have one state that I care about. But of course, usually we have maybe a family of states, so we can have some discrete collection, or we can also have some sets. So we can also require, for instance, that we have a state in some epsilon ball about around our state of interest. And this can, for instance, be relevant if we think about an implementation where there is some noise, then I think this is a natural thing. And we can impose this here, and then in a similar way to here, turn this into a constraint on what these measurement operators have to look like. Another thing that can also matter is that, okay, usually if you'd prepare the state of interest, you'd somehow send this to the referee, and it might be that this interacts with some environment in the meantime. Okay, and it can be that we don't really have control over this environment. So maybe we know how the interaction works. We have some interaction Hamiltonian and some interaction time, but we don't really know the state of the environment. And so then what happens is really that each copy interacts with this environment. And so because this environment we can't control, there can also correlations can build up there. And so this is a situation we can also reasonably naturally encounter. And this is also something we can take into account by here changing the conditions a little bit. And well, we'll see an example of this later. Okay, so now what happens if we actually do this? So the one thing that is still missing is what I kind of said in the beginning, what we really want, namely comparing different restrictions that we may have on the referee. Okay, so one thing that is certainly often of interest is, what if instead of doing global measurements on our state, we really only can do local measurements? Okay, and in kind of the spirit of a Maxwell-Deeming game, sometimes these are even fixed. So maybe I have a number of devices or some thing that fixes which measurements we can really do and which things we can choose. So for instance, in this case, now I assumed for example that these are Pauli measurements. So in this case, we assume that kind of the referee is made up of an Alice and a Bob who both choose among the three Pauli measurements and then get outcomes. Okay, so the sigmas here are the P of M elements that correspond to choosing a Pauli measurement X, where X is X, Y, Z now, and an outcome A, which is then an M plus or minus one. And there are two different ways of how we look at this. So one is kind of in a non-adaptive way, which just means that whenever a round starts, Alice and Bob both choose a measurement and then record their outcomes. And then this is passed on to the next round. So they don't talk to each other. And this is kind of then their measurement choices have to be chosen independently of the outputs they get, because they'll get the outputs later. So this is restricted in this way. Now, the other possibility is that we allow one party to go first. Let's say Alice here, she chooses a measurement, and then depending on her outcome, she tells Bob what her outcome was, and only then he can choose his measurement. So he can kind of adapt what he wants to do. And in this case, these are kind of the conditions that we have to impose on their choices. So Alice has to choose independently of their outputs, but Bob can actually make his choice dependent on Alice's output. Okay, and so this is what we call kind of an adaptive measurement choice in this case. So it's like a one-way LOCC thing. Okay, and now we can compare this. So for any state now, we can really just see what is the best they could do with those strategies. And we can see, of course, that the global measurements do best by quite a bit. And we can also see that there's a small difference between the other two. Okay, the errors here are quite large because it's a single shot. So it's just a one round thing. And so we just could not expect to do much better here. Okay, but now this is in one round, and then we can also go to more. So if we want to do more rounds, I'm now sticking with the adaptive poly measurements. What we have is just we have kind of in each round such an adaptive measurement, and then between the rounds we allow the player to provide us a new state, and we continue with the protocol. Well, from the referee's perspective, it's kind of the same as having an adaptive protocol between six parties. So the first Alice goes, then Bob, then the next Alice, then Bob, and so on. Okay, and so this means that really this overall measurement choice can be encoded in such a distribution where we just have linear constraints on this. And for the measurement, and from the player's perspective, we then have kind of this recursive decomposition that I showed on like the third slide or so, into the kind of constraints on then the different states they will present, they will send. Okay, but kind of I haven't written down the whole optimization problem here. But what is nice kind of about looking at those Maxwell-Deeming games is that because we have these parameters to optimize over, these probabilities, is that we can really do the global optimization. So it's not that we need to do a seesaw because we have some product measurement where we can't impose the constraints, but we just have a distribution with linear constraints and we can optimize everything. And so what we can then really say is that in the case where we have the measurements fixed to be, for instance, these adaptive poly measurements, we can really find the best protocol of what we could do with those. And now if we compare the one round thing from before to two or three rounds, we can see how the errors improve. And also that, of course, after three rounds, we've already kind of made up for not having the global measurements as well. There is one kind of difficulty with this, which is that this number of parameters in this Maxwell-Deeming games kind of still grow quite quickly. Okay, so because, yeah, there's just more probabilities to take care of. And so one thing then to consider if whether this is not maybe a bit of an overkill to have all this adaptiveness everywhere. So in particular, if we just think about kind of not the adaptiveness within the rounds, which we've kind of seen at the beginning in the single showcase that this is quite useful, but the adaptiveness between the rounds. And so why I'm saying this is because if we think about kind of detecting an entangled state, what we usually do in entanglement detection is, okay, we have a state, we want to detect this entanglement, we find kind of the best witness that we can implement with our means. And then we repeat this, okay? And so what one could think is that maybe it would be best to each round really do the kind of the best, implement the best witness. And even though the player can be adaptive, maybe the referee should kind of just do the best thing every time. Okay, of course, if we have done two states, this is definitely not the case anymore, because then we have different witnesses that may be good, and then it's quite natural to think that maybe a strategy is good where you use the first few rounds, so you can maybe have more than three as well, to find which of the two states you have. So you do something to distinguish those. And then after that, you use either the witness one or witness two. So in this case, kind of changing the measurement protocol should certainly help, and we find that this is also the case. But if we go back to this case of just this one state, so this could be this pure state from before, we actually find, and this came a bit as a surprise to us, that even then, it's not best to always do the optimal thing every round, but it's actually better to change what we do from round to round. Okay, so even if you have this one state, it's better to do different measurements and in fact adapt it depending on what has happened. I mean, now that we know this, of course, we can also explain it. So I think the idea is that, so if we have this particular state and want to compare it to states in the separable set, because the player has to kind of stay in its set that he can prepare, and somehow there are still some correlations that we have between the rounds in this sense. And it seems that this is kind of what also the referee can exploit to kind of make a better protocol and which is why this adaptiveness even helps in this case. Okay. So this I mainly mention because it was kind of a surprise for us, but also because it means that we cannot easily say, okay, we can just repeat this protocol, but actually kind of the adaptiveness is really helpful. And this means, of course, that if we want to then do protocols for more rounds, we need other ways. And of course, there are various ways to do this. So the simplest is really to just use those games that we've constructed. So for instance, this optimal 3-round game and play this M times. Okay, and then in each time, either we will say the state is entangled or we couldn't certify it. And then we will just accept it as entangled if we win V out of the M games that we played. Okay, so we just repeat this 3-round game and do this. And now what is nice about this, and it actually comes from this paper that is cited here, is that then we can, from the optimal strategy in the 3-round game, we can compute the optimal strategy also in our game. So for various players here, even though they can be adaptive also over the not just within 3 rounds, but over, like, if we repeat it 10 times, overall 30 rounds, and it turns out that actually the player's best strategy here we can find out just from the 3-round case. And what this means is that we can quite nicely find kind of the expected scores also for these larger games. So here I plot the curve that I had before. I just zoomed in a bit because otherwise it's all kind of stuck to the corner. But this is the curve from before, just kind of connected up of the 3-round game. And now if you repeat this 10 times and accept the state as entangled if we win 8 of the 10 games, then we see that we get these much, much better error pairs. And in this case, it's then also very easy to go to higher numbers. One thing to say, okay, now I could also do 30 times a 1-round game, which also does reasonably well, but the kind of using the 3-round game in this case is a bit better. So it may still be useful to kind of have the adaptiveness within the few rounds that we can. Okay, so this is a way to also get higher round numbers, which is quite important. So then, of course, this is not the only thing one can think of. And as a last thing, I kind of want to introduce a quite different way how to do this. So what we can also think of is not use our Maxwell-Deemann games, but just think of completely a different memory way of keeping the memory. So like in the preparation game with the gradient descent, we had the counter. We can just think that maybe we don't want the memory to grow. So what we can do is we can say in every round, we just allow 3 memory states. Okay, and then for each memory state, we have a measurement. And in this case, this would be a 4-outcome POVM, where 3 of the outcomes send us to either of the 3 states of the next measurement round. And one of them, in this case, we assume to abort already. And so we have 3 different measurements here that in each round that we would like to optimize and that kind of go on in the process. Okay, and this is a different way where we don't use the Maxwell-Deemann games, but we can just also optimize those measurements as a whole. And so I have an example of this. So now I took this example where we have this interaction with the environment that I mentioned. So the example here is that we will take 20 rounds and want to certify just the maximal entangled state. And what we assume is that we have such an environment and it will interact according to this Hamiltonian with it for 0.1 second. Okay, so what we will fix is the Hilbert space dimension of this environment. This we have to bound, but otherwise the state won't be fixed. And so what we then have is an optimization that is kind of this structure again. So we again have the two errors that we want to minimize. We again have this condition that the E1 error this constant is an upper bound for all separable states, and we can decompose this into constraints on the individual kind of round numbers. And we have here a constraint on the type 2 error that is now a bit more complicated than before, but essentially the gist is the same. And you can see here that this now holds for all environment state of an environment of that dimension. Okay, and this is again a problem where we can turn these two things into constraints on the measurements, and then we can optimize this. Now in this case we can't do the full optimization, but it's a seesaw optimization. So we fix all the measurements of all except one round, and then optimize the measurements of that round, and then we go on to the next round and so on, and we kind of sweep through the network until we don't improve anymore. Essentially, I think the example I have is about eight sweeps or so. Okay, and what we then get is something like this. So because we can't fully optimize, we don't get a nicely smooth curve, but we see that we just kind of 20 rounds and some random initial seeds for a measurement, we get kind of reasonably good error pairs already. And then of course this could be extended to more rounds and more seeds, and kind of also without an interaction with the environment, and this can be kind of played in many scenarios and in many ways and also be improved. But it's just kind of an example that this works out. Okay. Yes. Okay. And so this is, I think, all I wanted to tell you. So I have a short summary. So what I hope I could kind of convince you is that this framework of preparation games is rather versatile, and we can kind of use it to, for instance, describe hypothesis tests, but also find and analyze other games. In the case of Maxwell-Lehman games, we can really, really optimize the protocol. And we also found this example that from the viewpoint of entanglement theory is actually rather surprising. And then there are ways to either extend the Maxwell-Lehman games to larger round numbers, or completely different ways to find such protocols for larger round numbers, like the seesaw or things based on gradient descent, for instance. Of course, one could do much more as well. So for instance, we could do kind of multiple hypothesis testing as well, or other things. But I think one very important thing as well to say is that we could do other resources as well. So I've really focused on entanglement here. One thing we have also looked at is certifying high dimensional entanglement. And this is actually in this paper here, where we really looked at an experimental setup and kind of optimized how they should choose their measurements for detection of high dimensional entanglement. But of course, we could also do kind of more different things like non-locality or magic states. One thing I have to point out, especially if I mentioned that there are other applications, is that we do have an assumption in our framework that the referee has to conduct resource-free operations. Okay, and this means that essentially in the case of where we want to detect entanglement, it's not really so relevant, because if we do kind of a measurement on a separable state and condition on an outcome, the remaining state is still separable. And so in this case, it didn't restrict us. But of course, if we want to, for instance, look at magic states, then this is something we have to take into account. Because there we could now not do necessarily any POVM, but okay, Pauli measurements would be fine. But if, yeah, one might want to kind of relax or lift this assumption a bit. Another thing we haven't considered at all, and I think that would be very interesting, is that so far we have taken a referee who only had this classical memory. But really with NISQ devices coming, maybe it would be much more natural to say that the referee can actually hold some quantum memory of a certain dimension, so not as large as he wants, but something, and maybe with some additional restrictions. Because then one could actually find protocols or maybe optimize them. I don't know how this will go. That one could implement holding such a device, and this could lead to improvement. Another thing that we've also not thought about, and I think would also be interesting, is what will happen in the asymptotic case. So we found these examples where kind of our intuition was kind of not correct about whether adaptiveness should help. And so then one can also think, well, what happens if we go to an asymptotic limit? Could it also be that we find some surprises there? And so this could be something to potentially explore as well. Okay, and this is all I wanted to say. And I want to thank you for the attention.
Great, thank you, Miriam, for that very interesting talk. So we now have some time for questions. So please, if anyone has a question. Okay, so maybe I can start off the questions. So would you mind just saying a bit more about the extension to magic states? I don't think I quite got the subtlety you were talking about there.
Okay, so I mean, kind of in principle, you could also try to certify that you have a certain magic state. Mm-hmm. And you could also think of this, I guess, as a hypothesis test. But now kind of the problem is that if you allow any POVM, the referee to have any POVM, then it could be that the kind of the player gives him part of a non-magic state. But he could kind of, by measuring a subsystem and then conditioned on that outcome that he gets, it could be that then he could kind of leave a state that seems magic on the player's system. And so you have to make sure that this kind of cannot happen. So I don't know very much about magic state, so I can't give you kind of an explicit example, but this is kind of the idea. So in the case of entanglement, you could also see it as if you, for instance, allow, so some works allow there to be entanglement between all of the systems you give to Alice and all of the systems you give to Bob, but not across this bipartition. And that in that case, if you would allow the referee to do any measurement, what he could do is essentially entanglement swapping, which would mean that he could entangle systems and would in the next round think that Alice and Bob that the player prepared an entangled state just because he has kind of swapped this, and kind of these things lead to problems with really scoring the players, because then you can kind of score your ability to introduce this into their systems as well, and so in these cases you have to restrict. But okay, we have not really thought about how to lift this very much. But it's certainly something that could be an interesting question, I think.
Okay, so you say that the referee cannot do some certain subset of measurements because you're saying they could sort of accidentally do this and then get confused because the players haven't actually created the resource, but they've accidentally done this. Then in the next round, they think that the players have created this resource.
Yes.
Okay.
So yes, another way to avoid this is to say that the player also doesn't have a quantum memory, and then he has to really always just prepare it on the spot, mm-hmm. and you can also avoid this. But I think this is kind of not. not such a good assumption.
Cool. Okay. Thank you.
Can I just clarify? My understanding is that the bottleneck for the optimization is like the growth in the dimension of the SDP or the convex optimization. So I didn't see anywhere what's the formula for how the dimension grows? Like what drives the growth of the dimensionality?
Okay. Yes, this is a good question. Okay, it depends on various things. So there are several things. So one thing is that here we use the DPS hierarchy or the dual tweet. And so somehow one thing, it depends first, which with qubits, we're fine. But in general, it depends on which level we have to go here. And I guess this goes with one by k squared, I think, in the DPS hierarchy. I would need to look that up.
For k is the level?
Yeah, exactly. So it depends on this. And then in the round, And then if we stick to a level, what we really get is we get one of those constraints for every round. Okay. So let's assume we are in the case of qubits. So what this means is just that this can be essentially written is equal to some positive matrix plus the partial transpose of some positive matrix. But then we get, for each round, we get one of those constraints. Because we will use this recursive decomposition that I introduced very early on here. So we will have these mu parameters, and then for each of them, we will have one of those matrices. So with the round numbers, we get kind of two of those n by n matrices for each of the possibilities.
So that's increasing the dimension by n squared each time?
Sorry?
So that's increasing the dimension by n squared for each round number?
From
that. And the level of the hierarchy is just affecting the accuracy to which you're estimating the thing.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yes, but I actually am currently not. I cannot give you the exact number, but this is what it depends on. So I guess you need to count the free parameters there. In practice, we can go to about four or five rounds if we can stick to the first level of the hierarchy. So not very far, I guess.
So how does it depend on the system size? Like if it's a 2-qubit system or something at the start, does it depend on that?
Yes. Okay. So the two matrices like you need here, they have the size of the system. So yes, it does. I guess square in a squared way.
Okay.
For each of them, and then yeah.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
Okay. Do we have any more questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Miriam once again for a really interesting talk.